Chapter 110. Church, awaiting the advent of that time, when the mysterious laws of attraction shall draw them towards it in couples, we are desirous of addressing a few last words. Before marriage and afterwards, let them learn to center all their hopes of real and lasting happiness in their own fireside. Let them cherish the faith that in home, and all the English virtues which the love of home engenders, lies the only true source of domestic felicity. Let them believe that round the household gods, contentment and tranquility cluster in their gentlest and most graceful forms, and that many weary hunters of happiness through the noisy world have learnt this truth too late, and found a cheerful spirit and a quiet mind only at home at last. How much may depend on the education of daughters and the conduct of mothers, how much of the brightest part of our old national character may be perpetuated by their wisdom, or frittered away by their folly, how much of it may have been lost already, and how much more in danger of vanishing every day are questions too weighty for discussion here, but well deserving a little serious consideration from all young couples nevertheless. To that one young couple on whose bright destiny the thoughts of nations are fixed, may the youth of England look, and not in vain, for an example. From that one young couple, blessed and favored as they are, may they learn that even the glare and glitter of a court, the splendor of a palace, and the pomp and glory of a throne, yield in their power of conferring happiness to domestic worth and virtue. From that one young couple may they learn that the crown of a great empire, costly and jeweled though it be, gives place in the estimation of a queen to the plain gold ring that links her woman's nature to that of tens of thousands of her humble subjects, and guards in her woman's heart one secret store of tenderness, whose proudest boast shall be that it knows no royalty save nature's own, and no pride of birth, but being the child of heaven. So shall the highest young couple in the land for once hear the truth, when men throw up their caps, and cry with loving shouts, God bless them. The Mudfog and Other Sketches. Public Life of Mr. Tulrumble, once Mayor of Mudfog. Mudfog is a pleasant town, a remarkably pleasant town situated in a charming hollow by the side of a river, from which river, Mudfog derives an agreeable scent of pitch, tar, coals, and rope yarn, a roving population in oilskin hats, a pretty steady influx of drunken barchmen, and a great many other maritime advantages. There is a good deal of water about Mudfog, and yet it is not exactly the sort of town for a watering place either. Water is a perverse sort of element at the best of times, and in Mudfog it is particularly so. In winter, it comes oozing down the streets and tumbling over the fields, nay, rushes into the very cellars and kitchens of the houses, with a lavish prodigality that might well be dispensed with. But in the hot summer weather it will dry up and turn green. And, although green is a very good color in its way, especially in grass, still it certainly is not becoming to water, and it cannot be denied that the beauty of Mudfog is rather impaired, even by this trifling circumstance. Mudfog is a healthy place, very healthy, damp, perhaps, but none the worse for that. It's quite a mistake to suppose that damp is unwholesome. Plants thrive best in damp situations, and why shouldn't men? The inhabitants of Mudfog are unanimous in asserting that there exists not a finer race of people on the face of the earth. Here we have an indisputable and voracious contradiction of the vulgar error at once. So, admitting Mudfog to be damp, we distinctly state that it is salubrious. The town of Mudfog is extremely picturesque. Limehouse and Ratcliffe Highway are both something like it, but they give you a very faint idea of Mudfog. There are a great many more public houses in Mudfog more than in Ratcliffe Highway and Limehouse put together. The public buildings, too, are very imposing. We consider the town hall one of the finest specimens of shed architecture extant. It is a combination of the pigsty and tea garden box orders, and the simplicity of its design is of surpassing beauty. The idea of placing a large window on one side of the door, and a small one on the other, is particularly happy. There is a fine old Doric beauty, too, about the padlock and scraper, which is strictly in keeping with the general effect. In this room do the mayor and corporation of Mudfog assemble together in solemn council for the public weal. Seated on the massive wooden benches, which, with the table in the center, form the only furniture of the whitewashed apartment, the sage men of Mudfog spend hour after hour in grave deliberation. Here they settle at what hour of the night the public houses shall be closed, at what hour of the morning they shall be permitted to open, how soon it shall be lawful for people to eat their dinner on church days, and other great political questions. And sometimes, long after silence has fallen on the town, and the distant lights from the shops and houses have ceased to twinkle, like far-off stars, to the sight of the boatman on the river, the illumination in the two unequal-sized windows of the town hall warns the inhabitants of Mudfog that its little body of legislators, like a larger and better-known body of the same genus, a great deal more noisy, and not a whit more profound, are patriotically dozing away in company, far into the night, for their country's good. Among this knot of sage and learned men, no one was so eminently distinguished, during many years, for the quiet modesty of his appearance and demeanor, as Nicholas Tulrumble, the well-known coal dealer. However exciting the subject of discussion, however animated the tone of the debate, or however warm the personalities exchanged, and even in Mudfog we get personal sometimes, Nicholas Tulrumble was always the same. To say truth, Nicholas, being an industrious man, and always up bedums, was apt to fall asleep when the debate began, and to remain asleep till it was over, when he would wake up very much refreshed, and give his vote with the greatest complacency. The fact was, that Nicholas Tulrumble, knowing that everybody there had made up his mind beforehand, considered the talking as just a long botheration about nothing at all. And to the present hour it remains a question, whether, on this point at all events, Nicholas Tulrumble was not pretty near right. Time, which strews a man's head with silver, sometimes fills his pockets with gold. As he gradually performed one good office for Nicholas Tulrumble, he was obliging enough not to omit the other. Nicholas began life in a wooden tenement of 4 feet square, with a capital of 2 and 9 pence, and a stock in trade of 3 bushels and a half of coals, exclusive of the large lump which hung, by way of signboard, outside. Then he enlarged the shed, and kept a truck. Then he left the shed, and the truck too, and started a donkey and a Mrs. Tulrumble. Then he moved again, and set up a cart. The cart was soon afterwards exchanged for a wagon, and so he went on like his great predecessor Whittington, only without a cat for a partner increasing in wealth and fame, until at last he gave up business altogether, and retired with Mrs. Tulrumble and family to Mudfog Hall, which he had himself erected, on something which he attempted to delude himself into the belief was a hill, about a quarter of a mile distant from the town of Mudfog. About this time, it began to be murmured in Mudfog that Nicholas Tulrumble was growing vain and haughty, that prosperity and success had corrupted the simplicity of his manners, and tainted the natural goodness of his heart, in short, that he was setting up for a public character, and a great gentleman, and affected to look down upon his old companions with compassion and contempt. Whether these reports were at the time well-founded, or not, certain it is that Mrs. Tulrumble very shortly afterwards started a 4-wheel chaise, driven by a tall postillion in a yellow cap, that Mr. Tulrumble Jr. took to smoking cigars, and calling the footman a feller, apostrophe, and that Mr. Tulrumble from that time forth, was no more seen in his old seat in the chimney corner of the Lighterman's Arms at night. This looked bad. But, more than this, it began to be observed that Mr. Nicholas Tulrumble attended the corporation meetings more frequently than heretofore, and he no longer went to sleep as he had done for so many years, but propped his eyelids open with his two forefingers, that he read the newspapers by himself at home, and that he was in the habit of indulging a broad and distant and mysterious allusions to masses of people, apostrophe and the property of the country, apostrophe and productive power, and the moneyed interest. All of which denoted and proved that Nicholas Tulrumble was either mad, or worse, and it puzzled the good people of Mudfog amazingly. At length, about the middle of the month of October, Mr. Tulrumble and family went up to London, the middle of October being, as Mrs. Tulrumble informed her acquaintance in Mudfog, the very height of the fashionable season. Somehow or other, just about this time, despite the health-preserving air of Mudfog, the mayor died. It was a most extraordinary circumstance. He had lived in Mudfog for 85 years. The corporation didn't understand it at all. Indeed, it was with great difficulty that one old gentleman, who was a great stickler for forms, was dissuaded from proposing a vote of censure on such unaccountable conduct. Strange as it was, however, die he did, without taking the slightest notice of the corporation, and the corporation were imperatively called upon to elect his successor. So, they met for the purpose, and being very full of Nicholas Tulrumble just then, and Nicholas Tulrumble being a very important man, they elected him, and rode off to London by the very next post, to acquaint Nicholas Tulrumble with his new elevation. Now, it being November time, and Mr. Nicholas Tulrumble being in the capital, it fell out that he was present at the Lord Mayor's show and dinner, at sight of the glory and splendor whereof, he, Mr. Tulrumble, was greatly mortified, inasmuch as the reflection would force itself on his mind, that, had he been born in London instead of in Mudfog, he might have been a Lord Mayor too, and have patronized the judges, and been affable to the Lord Chancellor, and friendly with the Premier, and coldly condescending to the Secretary to the Treasury, and have dined with a flag behind his back, and done a great many other acts and deeds which unto Lord Mayors of London peculiarly appertain. The more he thought of the Lord Mayor, the more enviable a personage he seemed. To be a king was all very well, but what was the king to the Lord Mayor? When the king made a speech, everybody knew it was somebody else's writing, whereas here was the Lord Mayor, talking away for half an hour all out of his own head amidst the enthusiastic applause of the whole company, while it was notorious that the king might talk to his parliament till he was black in the face without getting so much as a single cheer. As all these reflections passed through the mind of Mr. Nicholas Tulrumble, the Lord Mayor of London appeared to him the greatest sovereign on the face of the earth, beating the Emperor of Russia all to nothing, and leaving the great mogul immeasurably behind. Mr. Nicholas Tulrumble was pondering over these things, and inwardly cursing the fate which had pitched his coal shed in Mudfog, when the letter of the corporation was put into his hand. A crimson flush mantled over his face as he read it, for visions of brightness were already dancing before his imagination. "My dear," apostrophe said Mr. Tulrumble to his wife, "they have elected me mayor of Mudfog." Apostrophe, "Lord mussy." Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Mrs. Tulrumble. "Why, what's become of old Snicks?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, "the late Mr. Snicks, Mrs. Tulrumble," apostrophe, said Mr. Tulrumble sharply, for he by no means approved of the notion of unceremoniously designating a gentleman who filled the high office of mayor as old Snicks. Apostrophe, "the late Mr. Snicks, Mrs. Tulrumble, is dead." Apostrophe, the communication was very unexpected, but Mrs. Tulrumble only ejaculated, "Lord mussy." Apostrophe, apostrophe, once again, as if a mayor were a mere ordinary Christian, at which Mr. Tulrumble frowned gloomily. "What a pity tant in London, ain't it?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Mrs. Tulrumble, after a short pause, "what a pity tant in London, where you might have had a show." Apostrophe, "I might have a show in Mudfog, if I thought proper, I apprehend," apostrophe, said Mr. Tulrumble mysteriously. "Lor, so you might, I declare," apostrophe, replied Mrs. Tulrumble. And a good one too, apostrophe said Mr. Tulrumble. Delightful. Apostrophe apostrophe exclaimed Mrs. Tulrumble. One which would rather astonish the ignorant people down there, apostrophe said Mr. Tulrumble. It would kill them with envy, apostrophe said Mrs. Tulrumble. So it was agreed that His Majesty's lieges in Mudfog should be astonished with splendor, and slaughtered with envy, and that such a show should take place as had never been seen in that town, or in any other town before, no, not even in London itself. On the very next day after the receipt of the letter, down came the tall postillion in a postchaise, not upon one of the horses, but actually inside the chaise, and, driving up to the very door of the town hall, where the corporation were assembled, delivered a letter, written by the Lord knows who, and signed by Nicholas Tulrumble, in which Nicholas said, all through four sides of closely written, gilt-edged, hot-pressed, Bath Post letter paper, that he responded to the call of his fellow townsmen with feelings of heartfelt delight, that he accepted the arduous office which their confidence had imposed upon him, that they would never find him shrinking from the discharge of his duty, that he would endeavor to execute his functions with all that dignity which their magnitude and importance demanded, and a great deal more to the same effect. But even this was not all. The tall postillion produced from his right-hand top boot a damp copy of that afternoon's number of the county paper, and there, in large type, running the whole length of the very first column, was a long address from Nicholas Tulrumble to the inhabitants of Mudfog, in which he said that he cheerfully complied with their requisition, and, in short, as if to prevent any mistake about the matter, told them over again what a grand fellow he meant to be, in very much the same terms as those in which he had already told them all about the matter in his letter. The corporation stared at one another very hard at all this, and then looked as if for explanation to the tall postillion, but as the tall postillion was intently contemplating the gold tassel on the top of his yellow cap, and could have afforded no explanation whatever, even if his thoughts had been entirely disengaged, they contented themselves with coughing very dubiously, and looking very grave. The tall postillion then delivered another letter, in which Nicholas Tulrumble informed the corporation that he intended repairing to the town hall, in grand state and gorgeous procession, on the Monday afternoon next ensuing. At this the corporation looked still more solemn, but, as the epistle wound up with a formal invitation to the whole body, to dine with the mayor on that day, at Mudfog Hall, Mudfog Hill, Mudfog, they began to see the fun of the thing directly, and sent back their compliments, and they'd be sure to come. Now there happened to be in Mudfog, as somehow or other there does happen to be, in almost every town in the British dominions, and perhaps in foreign dominions too we think it very likely, but, being no great traveler, cannot distinctly say there happened to. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.